We had an old friend round to spend some time with us yesterday. And we've known him for about 30 years, but he lives the other side of the world, so we only see each other every few years. And, you know, you do the usual catch-up on the family and friends. And he got talking about a couple, and I know the girl a little bit, and he was just describing her as a zany Brit, which is perfectly true, full of energy, has all kinds of wild ideas, and she's just got married to an Aussie. A normal, straight up and down, run-of-the-mill Aussie. I didn't know such people existed. But and his comment at the end was this. He said, they're a chalk and cheese couple. Hope it works. They're a chalk and cheese couple. I mean, you get couples like that, don't you? You get ideas like that that get sort of bunged together, and you think, how do those two fit together? Well, we're looking at some chalk and cheese couples tonight. I wouldn't necessarily pair them up, but it's vital to any Christian discipleship that they work. Here's the first chalk and cheese couple, and it's really there in verses 11 and 12. Friends, yet foreigners. Friends and foreigners. You see, that's how he begins in verse 11, isn't it? Dear friends. Peter writes, and when an apostle writes that like that to you, there is something warmly reassuring about it, isn't it? I mean, however tough a week you've had, the chin comes up when you know you're friend of the apostle. Never mind friend of the living God, which is what he really means. And actually, dear friends is a rather weak translation of what Peter actually wrote. Dearly loved would catch it far better. See, God sees those Peter is writing to as real friends of his. And yet, these are Christians who find life hard and hostile out there, who know something of what it means to be rejected by humans, as Peter described Jesus back in verse 4. It may be the workplace, it may be the home, it may be the campus, it may be school, it may just be talking with people in the pub, it could be a snide comment, a cold shoulder, being marginalized, or worse. And now Peter reinforces that other truth, rejected by humans, yes, but chosen by God. Spelt out there in verse 9, if you look back at it, you know, a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession. It would be enough to make any of us insufferably smug if verse 10 wasn't there, wouldn't it? You know, Hugh, how did you get to be so special? And I shrug and I smile, which is a very British way of saying I am wonderful. And then I read verse 10 and I have to say, well, as a matter of fact, it's because I received mercy. I received mercy. And now Peter reinforces all of that and sums it up as he writes, dear friends. He wants them to savor all that meant, friends loved by God. I wonder if we've got that in our heads as Christian disciples. I wonder if that's how we think of ourselves, friends with God. And then reality bites. In the next breath, he speaks of them as foreigners and exiles. Friends with God, yet foreigners in the world and culture around us. And we know that is reality, don't we? And someone said to me the other day, the Christian voice isn't listened to in the public square anymore, rather grumpily, and I was feeling in a snappy mood, so I just said, whatever made you think it would be? Well, they looked shocked. But I think they weren't facing up to reality, were they? They brought all the wrong expectations to the table. I mean, Rico's book, Honest Evangelism, is well worth the read, but I mean, I don't mean this unkindly. There are no great revelations from the 21st century in it. Rico is pinched. No, sorry. You will find all Rico's best ideas in Peter's letter. I mean, it's a letter to give me, well, not honest evangelism, but honest expectations for living as a disciple in an increasingly hostile culture. Expectations that face us up to reality and tell us, as some Christians need to be told, stop whining, it was in the job description. Disciples are friends, and yet foreigners. I mean, get that thought clear in my head and there'll be a reality about my discipleship. In fact, discipleship will just emphasize the tension. See, look how verse 11 goes on as Peter gets to his point. Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles, that's not only what you are, but what you ought to be, really, to keep living like that, like the foreigner, like the odd one out. So, dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Bit of an anticlimax, really, isn't it? It all began so well. Friend of God. And I kind of, fair enough, there'll be a battle, but I kind of expect God to sweep me to victory. And he says, keep saying no. Keep saying no. Keep sticking out like a sore thumb. And to abstain sounds just a bit limp and feeble, doesn't it? Yet saying no is the mark of someone who treasures their soul. Do you do it? Now, what wages war against your soul may not be the same thing as wages war against my soul, but any disciple will have to learn to say no. I don't know what it'll be to drink, maybe. I mean, the consumption of alcohol in evangelical circles has risen astronomically in the last 30 years. Not all of it healthy. To porn, and not just men, if the stats are to be believed. To gambling, and not just the Asian community. To greed, in whatever form it takes, you know, finance, food, fashion. Abstain, say no. But we're not defined by the negative. Look how he goes on, verse 12. Live such good lives among the pagans. Such good lives that they welcome you. They think you're wonderful. That they're glad to have you around. No, no, no. That though they accuse you of wrongdoing, honest expectations again. Doing good does not mean you won't get kicked in the teeth. Look at Jesus. There's a prejudice built into some of the pagans we live amongst that blinds them, skews their thinking and their speaking. And Peter wants us to get real about that. If I focus all my energies on getting a good response, I'm locked into disappointment. Live such good lives. That's what I can control. That's where I do have responsibility. How they respond to that, that's their problem. Live such good lives that though they accuse you of doing wrong, for some at least, that will not be end of story. See how he goes on? Though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. The day when God draws near to deal with us, either in judgment on that last day, or more likely here in mercy, when his Holy Spirit draws near and breaks into lives. Live such good lives. Let them see your good deeds. That's my job, not to put my knife into prejudiced pagans. It's the goodness that arouses hunger. Look, we've been there, haven't we? You've been to a restaurant. I don't know what you do when you go to a restaurant, but I'm nosy about what's coming to the tables around me. Don't you have a look around to see what's coming? Because before I order, I just want to see what it looks like, really. And you see some dishes, and they go there, and you think, oh, I see, you know, your meal, and I think that looks good. I am hungry. Well, Peter's saying he wants people to see your life. And to be saying, that looks good. I am hungry for God. When people talk about holiness and godliness and living good lives, don't shrink back into your silo and reduce it to being just about my relationship with God. See, as Peter writes, my holiness matters to my evangelism. Your holiness matters to your evangelism. Our goodness is vital to our mission as a church. There are countries in this world, there are communities and workplaces in this country even, when opportunities to speak are severely limited. A friend of God may be, but foreigner is all too true. What can't be limited and taken away is our opportunity to live such good lives. to present that appetizing, wholesome, hunger-inducing good meal in front of those we live amongst. Well, so someone, what do those good lives look like? And Peter spends much of the rest of his letter describing that, and the next paragraph introduces us to another chalk and cheese couple. And yet another pairing that every disciple needs to know. It's what I've called free to serve. And yet, stick freedom and service together, and you have to view both differently, strikingly differently. See, look at verse 16 for a moment. It brings this couple together, and it's at the heart of the paragraph, and Peter isn't writing to Christians who are cowed and subservient and towing someone's party line. He's not writing for that kind of, you know, that slightly dismissive way people describe Christianity as the Tory party at prayer, or it may be the Labour party at prayer, if you can tell the difference. But it's not that kind of thing he's writing for. These Christians are a small minority, certainly. They're a bunch of nobodies. When he writes in the next paragraph about slaves and masters, he's nothing to say to masters. Not because there is nothing to say. The New Testament says it on pretty much every other time it mentions them, but presumably Peter doesn't hear because there were no masters in the churches Peter's writing to. He's writing to those who are at the bottom of the pile as far as society is concerned. They aren't living in a democracy either, but under the authoritarian rule of kings and emperors and governors. And yet Peter has to write not to keep some repressive lid on, but because the gospel's like some time bomb that's going to be exploding in society, and he's anxious to channel the energy as well. So you see what he says in verse 16. Live as free people. And everything about what Peter writes here suggests his readers have got this message. They're breathing this gospel freedom. They believe what he wrote back in chapter 1 and verse 4 about them having an inheritance that can never perish or spoil or fade and kept in heaven for you. That world to come is the world that counts and is yours. A certainty for a future hope. Yeah, that transforms life if you're at the bottom of the pile. It means we can live now as those with nothing to lose, and yet we don't, do we? I mean, we live as those with plenty to lose, our standing and our status, our promotion and our pension, our respectability and our popularity. Live as free people. So liberating when you've nothing to lose. When you know that the truth of verses 9 and 10 here are your truth, you are very special people to God. Drink that intoxicating wine, and you'll need verses 13 to 17. Live as free people, he says. But not a freedom that has got no restraints. You see how verse 16 goes on. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Don't flaunt gospel freedoms of adoption and forgiveness as a reason to trample on goodness or distract attention from evil. There's none of that careless arrogance in this freedom. And suddenly, Peter brings us right down to earth with a bump again. You see how verse 16 ends? Live as God's slaves. Now, try and get those two together in your head. Live as free people, live as God's slaves. Free. Yeah, free to serve. And it's a godly thing, if you think about it, for the highest privilege to stimulate the lowest service. Remember Jesus in Philippians 2, who didn't count equality with God something to be used to his own advantage, but made himself a nobody? Took the very nature of a servant, a man, humbled himself, was obedient to death, even death on a cross. Well, so here, the chosen people, the royal priesthood, the special possession, the free people choose to serve. Submit yourselves, he starts the paragraph. Rank yourselves lower than. free to serve. There is something wonderfully attractive, isn't there, when those who have genuine privilege choose to serve. Expect to see it in Christian communities. Expect to show it as a Christian disciple. Martin Luther wrote a little paper called The Freedom of a Christian, and he put it this way. He said, a Christian is a perfectly free lord of all, subject to none. A Christian is a perfectly dutiful servant of all, subject to all. Now hold those two together, and you'll put together those chalk and cheese commands. Live as free people. Live as God's slaves. Free to serve. I've called it front foot living in that sense. You know, we sometimes talk about the need to get on the front foot, to stop endlessly having to respond to what's coming at us and take the initiative. You see, this kind of discipleship isn't just responsive, dutifully grudging, well, I suppose so, if I must, discipleship. Now, this picture is of free people who choose to serve their God, and serving God, they choose to serve others. As Christians, we're part of a society, and we don't use our freedom to kick over the traces, but to serve those who have God-given responsibilities for our society, as Romans 13 will explain. Which is why in our verse 13, he says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake, following his example, respecting his order for society, to every human authority, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority or to governors. Peter's expecting Christian disciples to be involved citizens, law-abiding, tax-paying, working for the good of the city. Christian communities aren't necessarily seedbeds of revolution, but understand, this is not a tyrant's charter. This isn't license for authorities to do what they want. History often speaks of the divine right of kings as of their God-appointed place, but kings and other rulers would do well to think more of the divine responsibility of kings. It's spelt out for them here in verse 14. To punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. That's how you build and protect a secure society. You know, as we head towards a general election and they've finally sorted the squabbling over who's going to appear on which television debate, don't let the politicians reduce it to a debate on the economy. At least, not as if the government's responsibility is just to provide for our material well-being. They're responsible for providing for our moral well-being too. So we shouldn't get mocked out of asking questions around social morality and how our society treats the vulnerable, the unborn, the in care, the elderly. Punish those who do wrong, commend those who do right. You see, justice matters for a society. Cover-ups for the establishment undermine it. It's why they need rooting out. The idea that tax evasion by the privileged is not pursued as rigorously as tax evasion by the less privileged debilitates it. When governments lose their moral compass, the heart goes out of a nation. Punish those who do wrong, commend those who do right. And the Christian disciple will choose to put their energies in line with authorities that reflect those responsibilities for a country. Submit yourselves. It is a choice, it's a free will decision that puts other interests first, ranks ourselves below, a choice that puts us on the front foot and asserts that we are free to serve. And we do. Not a tyrant's charter, not either an excuse for evil. You notice in verse 16 it said, live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Well, in verse 13 he says, submit yourselves. He could have gone on to say, but do not use your submission as a cover-up for evil. In the New Testament, the command to submit is never an excuse for doing wrong. And it's not an excuse here. They told me to, won't wash. Look at the pattern of what Peter's saying. Back in verse 12, he talked about live such good lives that they may see your good deeds. And in this next paragraph, at the heart of it in verse 15, he writes this, for it is God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. By the way, isn't that striking? It is not our wonderfully reasoned arguments, but our goodness that silences ignorance. And Peter's not saying, don't worry if it's not the right thing so long as you submit. In fact, it is doing the right thing that is his top priority. And that's how he lived too. Keep a finger in 1 Peter, will you? We're coming straight back, but just turn to Acts chapter 4. You'll find it on page 1096 if you've got a church Bible. And watch how Peter worked this one out. He could be a sparky character in his time. And he was here in Acts chapter 4. And Peter and John, you may remember, have been arrested for preaching Jesus in the temple surrounds. And they're up in front of the court. And it reaches its verdict in verse 18. And in verse 18 of Acts chapter 4, they say this, then they called them in again and commanded them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John replied, which is right in God's eyes, to listen to you or him? You be the judges. It's very striking, isn't it? Peter and John don't have a GCSE between them. And they're up in front of all the big religious power players of the day. And they... You know, it's pretty clear which way they think that they should decide, but they don't usurp or deny the court's authority. No, they must judge, they can decide, they can act, but until they do, Peter and John will do what's right. As for us, verse 20, we cannot help speaking about what we've seen and heard. Now, free to serve. Yeah, holding those together is such a potent mix. As you come back to 1 Peter, notice this, you see, it's not a tyrant's charter, it's not an excuse for evil, and it's not an exclusive club that he's describing here either. What is so attractive about these Christian communities Peter's writing to is that they are not exclusive sects keeping themselves to themselves. They've high commitments to one another, but generous hearts to others. Look at verse 17. Look at the balance mixed into this sentence. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor. There's something wonderfully inclusive about this, isn't there? A real love for one another, a genuine community, but one that permeates the society around it. I remember in... our previous church in Sheffield, just starting to meet with everyone who was on the membership roll and discovering the kind of things that they did and they were involved in, what their lives were full of, and realized that never mind the church ministries and, you know, church-labeled activities, these people were involved in so much of the life around. I was talking with someone else. He said, I think if the church went out of existence, half the charities in Sheffield would fold. Because people were involved in the community. Show proper respect to everyone. We've got a growing ministry, as many of you will know, to those caught in human trafficking and the sex trade around here. And just the other day, there was a meeting with a rather suspicious official, and they said in the end, look, tell us, what's the problem? What are you worried about? And the official came out and said, look, what if you came across gay or transgendered people? And the leader said, well, they're part of the community. We'd serve and care for them the same as everyone else. Just what you should have said. Suspicion over. Fear God. And he calls us to honor the emperor. Give to Caesar what's Caesar's. You know, don't join an HSBC-type tax evasion scheme. Give authorities the respect they deserve. Yeah, give to Caesar what Caesar's. Give to God what's God's. His is the primary allegiance. But we want to say to the world outside, my God, your God actually, wants me to rank you above me. It's why loyal Christian citizens remain a threat to power brokers, because we're free to serve. A friend, but a foreigner. Freedom, yeah, shown in service. Yeah, may those chalk and cheese couples be our characteristics. May they work in us. Well, let's sing our final song. Freedom and life are ours.